Welcome to the Strategic Tech Coaching Podcast. Our host, Oscar Endermo, will together with guests share proven, tested strategies for improving your life and business. At the end of each episode, you will learn how you can use technology to implement those strategies into your daily life. We want to help you bridge the gap from inspiration to implementation.
Hi, welcome to another episode of the Strategic Tech Coaching Podcast. Over the years, I've had the opportunity to talk and interview some of the top speakers in Sweden. I had people like Kjell Enhager, Lasse Gustafsson, and also Al Pitcher, who is one of the top stand-up comedians in Sweden. So today it was fun because I had the opportunity to speak to one of the top speakers in Dubai, or maybe the top speaker in Dubai. His name is Dave Crane. He has worked with some of the world's best-known brands and leaders for the past 30 years. I met him maybe 10 years ago in Dubai, and he's a great guy, and he inspires, educates, and entertains when he does his keynotes. He has hosted events that have been broadcasted live to over 2 billion people and performed to audiences of over 50,000 people in a stadium. So he's done like big things. And yeah, he's been a speaker for many, many years and has lots of experience in this industry. And this podcast is for ambitious leaders and entrepreneurs just like you that want a happy, successful, and productive life. So yeah, we get to learn from Dave Crane, and he shares a little bit how you can reinvent yourself during tough times. He talks a little bit about building a personal brand, and also he gives some super valuable tips on how to use LinkedIn in a better way to get leads. So some really useful tips in this episode. So yeah, here we go. Dave has more than 30 years of experience in this field. So yeah, I recommend you to really listen to this episode and learn. But here we go.
Dave Crane, welcome to the Strategic Tech Coaching Podcast.
Oscar, it's an honor to be on your podcast, and it's so good to see you. People don't know how close we've been for how many years? Yeah, we've known each other for almost, 20 years, something like that?
No, 10 years, I would say. Yeah.
10 years. It's a blur. I'm getting old, so yeah. 10 years, but it's still quite a long time.
Yeah, exactly. So I have this question that I've used to all my guests, and it's to pretend that they are in Dubai, but you don't have to pretend because you are in Dubai.
I'm in Dubai.
Pretend that you and me, we go to your favorite sky bar in Dubai. Which is your favorite sky bar in Dubai?
Well, I don't have one anymore. Let me be completely transparent about this. The last 2 years of lockdown have meant that I've kind of changed my business model to now be based in my home studio and then do business with people all around the world. And so when people are saying, let's have a meeting, come to the office, I'm like, no, let's jump on Zoom, because I'm not sitting in traffic to anybody for ever again. So
you like to work in your underwear, right?
Sorry, say again?
You like to work in your underwear, so...
Well, doesn't everybody?
Exactly.
Let me just clarify. I'm not just in my underwear now. That would be really freaky. If I was watching it, I would be watching like a train wreck, saying, I don't want to see it, but I can't take my eyes off it just in case it's true. I'm wearing shorts, so it's okay.
Yeah. No, so my question is normally to my guest is, pretend that you and me, we are in an elevator going up to one of the sky bars in Dubai, and there's a third guy in the lift, and he asks Dave Crane, so what do you do? And what would you tell him?
I'm an international keynote speaker who trains international keynote speakers to brand themselves, and we learn how to jump and grow wings on the way down.
Yeah. So in Dubai, you've been around for a long time, and a lot of people know who you are. Your brand is quite big in Dubai, I would say. How long have you lived in Dubai?
I've been there 30 years, and it's something that, I mean, I don't like to blow my own trumpet, but I've now apparently earned the title legend. People say, Dave Crane, oh yeah, he's a legend. But that doesn't mean anything. It means, oh, he's not dead yet. So I don't know whether legend means you've lasted that long in Dubai or you should have gone. I mean, I hosted the Dubai Rugby Sevens for 20 years. Going out in front of an audience of 100,000 people with a microphone and a TV audience of up to a billion people watching at home for 20 years. Now, that's the longest I can think of anybody doing anything. Mm. And so that is legendary, but
that's
I'm not doing it now. So what's the matter?
Yeah, that's how you get to legendary status. Yeah. There's a lot of misconceptions about Dubai around the world. So there's just a few percent of the listeners in Dubai on this podcast. There are listeners all over the world. So those that are not that familiar about Dubai, what would you tell them?
Right. So this is a question. Dave, can you say lots of things about Dubai that will mean that there'll be a knock on the door in the middle of this podcast and you go missing? And you know what I'm talking about. I've been in Dubai 30 years. And one of the things I love about Dubai is it's a benevolent dictatorship. You've got you've got the rulers of the country who make all the decisions, but they care about the people in it. And they care about the people in it because they know about the power of word of mouth. So they want to make sure that they create an environment that people from across the world would come to, live there, make it their home, raise their family, bring their skills, drive business, and feel comfortable. So there are sometimes some bad press about Dubai, which sometimes is justified, but after 30 years, it's the safest, most wonderful place I could have ever spent the last 30 years. The opportunities are here. And I think the best way to summarize it is when lockdown happened around the world, we locked down for 3 weeks, then 2 weeks. Then the government made it abundantly clear, you can come out if you're wearing masks. And if you do social distance, sanitize and get yourself vaccinated. We've got vaccines for everybody. And then when people wanted to have a Pfizer one, they got a Pfizer one vaccinated. Sheikh Mohammed he was one of the first people to get the vaccine just to prove to the world, I'm getting the vaccine. So if I'm getting it, and you know that he's not going to, whoever's advising the Sheikh is not going to say, oh, try this. I'm trying it myself, but it might be a good idea. So that's Dubai. The rulers here are incredible at making a decision about what's going to make the country grow. They're incredibly welcoming. And I think the only challenge for anybody is when you're winning, Dubai is fantastic. When you're not winning, it becomes very expensive and very challenging. And winning is business, relationships, and health.
Yeah.
Any of these things can drop you below the surface, and then you realize that you are from overseas, you are an expat, and you need to have some kind of cushion to be able to make it all work. And I think that you'd agree with most of that. That's about right, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I lived 13 years in Dubai and I love the place. I think it's such a nice global hub. You meet people from all over the world. I mean, I learned so much about the world living in Dubai. But like you say, there's in Sweden, when COVID hit, there was a lot of things put in place. I mean, you could get furlough, you can get money from the government, you can get the support systems. But of course, in Dubai, if you're an expat, there's not many support systems. So that's a bit of a challenge. So let's go to the next point, which is, it's been a rough year for, I think, both of you and me. And for me, in March of 2020, I was sitting out in the desert. I just did a team building for a group in the desert. I had a sitting there watching the sunset in the desert. It was just amazing. Just looking at the year ahead, and it's like, wow, this is going to be an amazing year. I had a lot of things booked for Expo for the autumn. And, you know, I have built up my business over 10 years' time, events, team buildings, training, speaking. It's like, wow, it's going to be an amazing year. 2 weeks later, I'm locked down in my apartment. And I think you have a similar story. Like, most of your income was from live speaking gigs, right? And
all my income was from live speaking or training people to do live speaking. Yeah. So whether that's facilitating an event or doing an international event and traveling around the world, or looking after CEOs and decision makers and politicians on one-to-one training, or running groups of people who would come to my own training so I'd have a classroom full of people, it turned out to be a very lucrative and successful business. And then with immediate effect, that sunset you saw was our careers just fading into darkness. And I found myself locked in the house, absolutely petrified about how am I going to make it work? Because Dubai's not cheap. Got to pay school fees, got to pay rent, got to look after my family, got to pay off two cars. I'm going to look after two dogs. And I would never have said we've got to eat our dogs, but it was that kind of thing where you're wondering, where are we going to, how are we going to make this work? Because the world was petrified. But here's the thing that's more challenging for you and I and anybody in hospitality or in entertainment and events. The rest of the world carried on turning, just people work from home. Because we need to have people physically there and joining us, it was impossible until the vaccines had been there or until you got some guarantee that people are actually going to be able to turn up to your event for us to be booked or to book and to go to work. So I worked flat out, and I have worked flat out for 2 years, even to the point where I didn't realize I had burnout. I didn't realize I had depression and anxiety because I was fighting every day, all day long. Even if there's nothing going on, you don't want to drop the ball or the appearances, because you want to make sure that when the dust does settle, people say, Dave, I loved you. You got me through the lockdown. Therefore, I'm going to reward you. Come and work with our team. So you don't want to take your foot off the gas. And the first thing that we did, myself and Ernesto Verdugo, who you know very well, mutual friend of ours, is we created a TV show called The Toilet Paper Diaries. And I was based in Dubai. He was based in Texas, Houston, which he still is. And we went live using software that allowed us to broadcast together onto Facebook. And at the time, we were getting about 1,000, 1,500 people a day watching, which is phenomenal by streaming terms nowadays. But at the time, we didn't even think about it. We're just thinking, right, let's just go live and see who turns up. And the great and the good and the famous and so on were watching the show. And we did it for about 50 episodes. We have actually got to about 100 episodes now. But we did about 30 days on the trot, expecting it to be over after about 3 weeks. Oh, how naive we were. And we went from what was just a chat like we're doing right now to becoming quite a sophisticated show with graphics and intro themes and all the rest of it. And a large amount of that was down to Ernesto and the hard work he was putting into production. Because it was like, imagine there's a nuclear war and you jump into a car with your friends and you drive. Whoever's in the driving seat drives the car. So Ernesto had the software and so he was driving the show. And so eventually, I mean, he got burnout faster than me because the production that went into making it happen, whereas I just needed to turn up and share some ideas, caught up with him. So we then managed to pace it to being a couple of times a week. And then we brought it down to being about once a week and so on. And that was manageable. But over the period of time, I started my own shows. I did various different ones. I must have done about 200 shows, live shows, over that year and a bit. And it taught me a lot about the online space, which is great for everybody, but it's not quite what people are embracing yet. But they, I do believe they will do. Even going back to in-house events and in-person events, I think that if you miss out on the potential audience that could be sitting at home and you don't allow them to watch it as well, you're missing out on a massive opportunity because the world is effectively now flat.
Mm. So what advice would you give to someone, or what lessons do you take from these years when you had to reinvent yourself? And like, what are some lessons and advice you would give to someone that in a similar tough situation?
Well, my motto is jump and grow wings on the way down, which means taking calculated risks. I think you've got to look at who you are, what you do, who's your audience, and what do they want? Not what do they need, what do they want? And what can you offer them that's the lowest hanging fruit in the garden that makes it cost effective for you to deliver and you'll be able to start making some money out of it? So my business now is I train people how to do the Industry Icon program. So I work with industry experts who aren't branded very well and teach them how to become celebrities in their niche. Now, this is different from being an influencer. An influencer can say, look at this, I'm eating my dinner. Don't I look gorgeous with my makeup on and this dinner? That's your typical influencer, you know, got a million followers and they get paid just to smile. What I work with is people who know their stuff really well. And so when they start talking about stuff, they can be ugly because it doesn't matter. What you want is their expertise. But the more they brand themselves, the more that they sell certainty and that you want to associate with them. So I would say that the key to it now is to find out what you do really well, like potentially best in the world. What do you love to do so you never get bored doing it? And also the third thing is, what are people willing to pay for? What's your business model? That could mean dumping 99% of the stuff that you do and finding one sweet spot. But for me, it's relatively easy. I mean, I say easy, you've got to reinvent the business. I was a speaker training speakers to do big events. I went online, learned to be online, and eventually through just finding what was people were willing to pay for, discovered in my case, they're willing to see my expertise of how I got to that point and have me train them on how they could get to that point of being a celebrity who can turn their hand to lots of different stuff. Because if you get a CEO who's in charge of a big company, then his word is worth quite a bit, depending on how well the people know the CEO and how other people love that company. But if that person's also a celebrity, like an Elon Musk or a Bill Gates or a Mark Zuckerberg, who is a bit like a Bond villain, or let's take Richard Branson. When they say something, even unrelated to their business, it means that people have more faith in them, more faith in their business, and their stock rises. So for any company, especially entrepreneurs waiting to launch themselves onto the market, build your brand. Because the minute you talk, the minute you're available to see and share your thoughts and comments, people associate it that the values align with them and the success aligns with them. They want to see what else you have to offer, and then they look at your business as well.
Mm. Yeah, no, I was thinking when you were talking about Elon Musk, for example, and Tesla, and you know how you have the Tesla brand and you have the personal industry icon brand, you know. So, and when you think of Apple, you think of Steve Jobs, and you know, both have a brand value kind of.
But you can also get it wrong. So, for instance, many years ago, probably about 20, 30 years ago, there was a guy called Gerald Ratner who owned a series of jeweler shops. And they were cheap and cheerful. They were good. I mean, you'd buy them if you're a mid-range. They weren't top range, but certainly the shops were everywhere. And so he made some throwaway comments. I'm not sure if he did to the press or did to some friends. And it got publicized that we sell crap, cheap crap. And it killed his business within a couple of weeks. Nobody would buy any of his stuff. He went bankrupt. And now he's a motivational speaker, a bit like Wolf of Wall Street, telling everybody about his tale and so on. And so you've got to make sure that whatever you say out there is optimized so you become very well respected, because you're telling people what they want to know. They don't want to know the truth about you. They want to know the truth about you that makes them feel better and helps them grow their business. And be very careful that the vision that you give them and the version of you that you portray is one that can sustain your business. Don't tell them the truth. If you're having a crappy day, just don't talk until you feel better.
So, we'll post some links to your Industry Icon program to this show so people can learn more about this. What are like some ways you need to think about to become that industry icon?
Well, I don't think that everybody should become an industry icon. I really don't. I'll tell you why. Because most people want a job. Most people, and I'm guessing, but I don't know exact figures, I'd say probably about 90%. I'm looking at Dubai because I've been there 30 years. Most people who go to Dubai come for a job. They want to be employees. Now there's more entrepreneurs. Now there's a great resignation of people starting a side hustle or deciding, if I'm going to work from home, why don't I just work from home for myself anyway? I think there will be a backlash of people coming back to offices, but there will always be a hybrid workforce, which is fascinating and brilliant and great for you and great for me, because we empower people and get them to be better at what they do, because not everybody's motivated by their natural instincts. So I think that the way that people will be moving in the future is that they will have to consider their own brand. Even if it's just a brand to allow them to be headhunted or they go for a job interview, people will look at your LinkedIn and they'll look at your Facebook or your Instagram and look for the term serial killer or a drug dealer or if you say bad words or you show really private stuff. That's why people are looking at you. Social media is your badge. It's your offer to the world. So I've always been very careful with my social media. Very few people know the real truth about me. It's not that I'm sinister or anything, but I wouldn't put any, if I was having a hangover or a bad day, unless I strategically wanted to position it, I'd never say that. So if I'm having a bad day, I will post about the importance of turning your bad days into good days. So that means that people can see what the transformation is that you're going through. But now you're having a bad day. I mean, they'll say, I hope it feels better tomorrow, but it means that you've got to leave them with something else. Otherwise, what you do is you overstay your welcome. Or people look at it and say, well, you know, it's a bit of a headache following this guy. I don't want to. And I think that anybody who doesn't do this and start positioning themselves as a brand alongside their business or alongside what they want it to be, they'll still survive. They'll still get jobs, but they'll find it much, much harder to be visible on a world that's now flat.
Okay. Build that personal brand and find the sweet spot where you can make some money. For me, when I came back to Sweden in 2020 in the summer, I met my old network, and I left Sweden 2007, and that time I was working for Sheraton in Stockholm, and I connected with some of my friends from my old network in hospitality, and they were either unemployed, about to fire half of their staff, or you know. So you had to find other industries, and there are other industries that were doing good, actually. So at the end of 2020, I started working with unemployed people and giving talks. And that was an industry that was doing really well. It was sponsored by the Swedish government, but right. You know, there was a lot of people unemployed after COVID. So just find that sweet spot where there is money and you can contribute with your strengths.
Yeah, I agree with you. But the challenge is, I mean, if the government's going to subsidize you and you're working with that particular group, then that's fantastic. And good luck to you. And it really helps. I mean, there's one of the things, if you're a life coach, life coaches traditionally are skint. They've got no money because they're terrible at marketing and people won't pay for happiness.
Yeah.
But I think that the pandemic has changed a lot of that. But the life coaches, so you've got off the top of my head, say you've got 10 million life coaches around the world or 1 million life coaches, 1 million life coaches around the world. most of them didn't get income, because when you have to do that initial time of people putting your 100 hours for free so you can get qualified, well, people just get used to 100 hours for free. And so unless you're ready to say, pay me now, people go, I've already had all that. I'm not going to pay for that. And so I think the smart life coach will realize that there's a problem with the pandemic. After the post-pandemic world, people got mental, emotional health problems, even if they got a job. But what you need to do is align yourself with doctors. Doctors have a traditional business model of come and see me. Okay, give me some money and you can go next. And so I'm not knocking doctors for what they can do, but the business model is within 2 minutes, I'll diagnose what's wrong with you, unless it's a broken arm, or I'll give you a placebo, because I don't know what it is, but in 7 days, you'll probably be fine. Otherwise, you'll come back and I'll do a bit more work. Now, that's not just how it is with everybody, but a lot of it is that. So in 2 minutes, the doctor's not going to fix you. But if you need longer, why doesn't the doctor turn around and say, I can tell that your problems also have a psychological issue. Let me give you a range of coaches or the ones that I recommend. Give them a call. It'll cost you X amount of money, or maybe the government subsidize it. And then the people get the care that they really need to be able to get back on track again, because we've got a generation that are damaged. And I can't even think, Oscar, what the age is who's more damaged than anybody. If you're older, like my mum, you know, you're on your own in isolation, worrying about whether you're going to die or not. And every single thing that arrives at your house or person is a potential time bomb. Mm-hmm. If you're young, you're worried about, you know, where's all my friends gone? I can't go out to play. I'm on my iPad. I don't really talk to people anymore. They're not worried about it, but that's the circumstances for youngers. But if you're like, I mean, can you imagine going back to being single? So you're like, let's say 18 to 30 as just a demographic, and you spend the last 2 years not being able to meet anybody physically, but you can talk to them online. And then when you do meet them, there's always a worry that, I mean, there's a time bomb. I mean, I remember you and I, not personally, but when AIDS was a thing, and you thought you could catch it from looking at somebody or breathing to somebody, not from whatever AIDS turned out to be. Well, COVID is that. And I can't even imagine what it's like. And then you got an older group, which is our kind of group, where you got a family to look after, or you got bills on companies and so much. So I don't really know who has it easy. I just know that there's a ton of people out there who don't know that they're damaged and need help, who do need that help.
Yeah. For the coaches that are listening, that's a great advice from Dave Crane. Get some leads from doctors, or find other people that are serving the same kind of client. That's a brilliant
idea. Get qualified, get your marketing, have meetings, and become recommended. Don't do it as a favor. Make sure you've got a business with a website that looks referable. It's got to look like the doctors would feel it as an extension of their business, not, oh, there's a bored housewife who took a course. No disrespect to bored housewives that took a course. You've got to be able to play the game so the doctor sees it as an extension of his practice or her practice. And then you'll get clients just sent to you, which is fantastic. Maybe you pay commission to a doctor. But if you've got enough big people coming through, happy days.
LinkedIn. I checked that you have more than 60,000 followers on LinkedIn, which is quite an impressive number. And do you do any other social media, or just focusing on LinkedIn? Or...
The danger is, if you don't do other social media, LinkedIn could kick you off, or it could get bought out by somebody that closes it down. So Vine and numerous other ones that have been up, and, you know, millions of followers for certain people, lost everybody overnight when they closed. So I tend to do LinkedIn, but I also post reluctantly on Facebook, because I know that Mr. Zuckerberg might not have my best. Sorry, on Meta, do we call it Facebook? But yeah. Anyway, so Facebook, I'm not in love with, but I do know a lot of people are on it. So I do post on there, especially personally, and Instagram and Twitter. But I do whatever goes on to LinkedIn goes on my Twitter as well. Mm. I hadn't extended myself to TikTok. I know that TikTok can be amazing, but there was a survey done recently, which I shared on LinkedIn, that said that now the agencies that were surveyed, there's about 2,000 agencies, I believe, say that the best way to reach clients and get business done is no longer sending emails, it's using social media. And by far, by 85%, it's LinkedIn. You look at TikTok, it's 7%. Look at YouTube, something like 36%. And Instagram is about 46%. So by large, going up the food chain, doing LinkedIn, being constructive on it, and connecting is the best way to drive your business if you're doing B2B or B2C.
Yeah. So we talked about building that personal brand, and you're great at LinkedIn. I see you have a lot of engagements on your posts. Any advice for those that want to build a personal brand, how they can use LinkedIn?
Google it. Like anything, just Google it. We're in an age now where there's more information than you could ever dream of, and tons of it is free. So rather than just me giving advice, go on Google, go on YouTube and say, how do I build up my LinkedIn profile? But also, when you read somebody's stuff or you watch new stuff, have a look at them. See who it is they're talking about. You and I, for instance, Oscar, we've been in a world where there's gurus everywhere. Turn over a stone and there's a guru. I'll teach you how to become a millionaire. And they won't even get around in. And you're like, well, what? So you've studied a course in wealth creation, but you've got no money. No, but I'm working towards it. Well, stop telling me how to be a millionaire if you're not a millionaire. So what I would do is I'd cross-reference everybody. Like, for instance, Clubhouse. When Clubhouse came along, I went to Clubhouse. I did it for a while. I actually picked up quite a few clients from Clubhouse. But then there's a LinkedIn group of people, a couple of LinkedIn rooms, where people would say, this is how to be successful on LinkedIn. And I jumped in and I would contribute where I could. But I'd watch people with like 3,000 or 5,000 followers telling the whole room, this is what you should do. And I'm thinking, well, if that's what you should do, and you're telling other people not to do it their own way, why haven't you got more people? And don't tell me you're very specific about who you let in, because when you've got 3,000 to 5,000, that's not enough to be able to turn around, because 30,000 is the limit of how many people can be direct connections. That's when you're kicking people out all the time, because you want to be able to add new people who are going to enhance your business. And if you've got 3,000 to 5,000, you've not even had that question. You've just added people or you've turned down people, but you're not getting enough traction. So you might get some interaction, but you're not reaching enough. I would suggest the thing to do is initially invite everybody you want to work with in the industries that you want to work with. I forced myself to spend 4 hours a day in the early days on LinkedIn. I'd come back from my long drive from Dubai back to Sharjah. In those days, I lived in Sharjah. And I spent from 8 o'clock until 12 on LinkedIn, adding people from businesses I wanted to do business with. So for instance, at the time, Red Bull. So I've got about 300 connections on Red Bull worldwide, because I added, and I've not ever done any business with Red Bull, but you'd go Samsung, Microsoft, and you just offer to the companies that you want to do business with. So I would connect with them. I'd create some great content that people want to see that's interactive, that positions you as doing what you do. I'd write some articles so when they look at you, they can see about you fully rounded. But also, here's a really useful trick. When you do LinkedIn, LinkedIn has got its very own search engine, like a mini Google. So when people search for you, you can come up higher if the keywords that you've got are in your profile. Now, most people treat LinkedIn like a CV. It's not. It's not. It's more like a web page. So if you can run several profiles of what you do, even tasks as what you do, and run them concurrent, then what you can end up doing is changing the keywords around slightly. So for instance, for me, I'm an international keynote speaker, but I'm also a keynote speaker trainer internationally. And the next one I might say, so I end up with all these keywords being built up on every profile that I've got. So when somebody starts searching, there's a better chance of getting up to the high points. Now, I studied this. I did a course on it from udemy.com, which is a great source of all this stuff. And I got myself in the rankings of the top 10 speakers on LinkedIn. But in fact, I wasn't top 10. What it was top 10 international speaking, not international speaker. Mm-hmm. Why? Because speaking is a word that you could rank with, because there's so much competition on speaker. You couldn't rank on that. So I changed a lot of my profiles. So there's a ton of things. There's a real science behind doing LinkedIn. I think being transparent and letting people know what it is that you offer, but also giving great value. But don't fall down that route of just taking stuff off YouTube, bunging it on LinkedIn and saying, oh, look, there's a fireman who caught a cat from a tree and now the cat's okay. Isn't life wonderful? Everyone does that. Do something that's individual, that if people look at you, they can see why they'd buy from you just because they engage your post.
Yeah, so, and of course, one of the things you can do is to look at those that are successful on LinkedIn and check their profiles. And when I was working on my LinkedIn profile last summer, I actually looked at yours, Dave Crane, and tried to get some inspiration from yours and some other also in the
same
field.
So what were your thoughts on mine?
I loved it. And there was a lot of things that I can take, but I think even more is how you write engaging posts. And that's something that I need to get better at, because sometimes you just want to put something out and you know, but to write engaging posts is, I will study you for the coming months, Dave.
No worries, and everyone's welcome to do it.
I've yeah, exactly. So everyone that is listening, follow Dave Crane on LinkedIn, because yeah, he has a very good profile and he's very good at his LinkedIn.
Well, just to illustrate, I've got my own mentor as well, who I hired to teach me how to be better at what I do. Very successful, multimillionaire author and so on. And one of the things that we've been working on is how to do proper posts that convert. So I've been, it takes me on average when I do a sales post, maybe 3 to 4 hours to write that post. Now that sounds ridiculous. However, when you realize that every single post is converting to an appointment with a client, and in some cases, 4 or 5 appointments from one post. Mm. It makes you think, wow, that's a bit of free marketing you hadn't considered. And when you write that as sales copy, you can take that sales copy, turn it into a video because you've got script for it. You can turn it into a landing page because you know it converts. And suddenly it's worthwhile spending time on those posts. But don't sell all the time, because it's like walking up to somebody at a party and they say, right, take my business card, tell me how I can help you. You're like, no, yeah, beer. Yeah, I thought you were a good person to drink beer with. So create relationships with people as well.
Yeah, no, that's one of the mistakes that I've done, I think, because I got so excited whenever I do something and I post it, and then it's like, well, so what, you know, like, but yeah, engaging post, learn from Dave Crane. And that's, I mean, you can spend those 3-4 hours trying to cold call people, and that doesn't work anymore. So then instead,
amazing and creepy.
Exactly. So then spend some time adding value instead on LinkedIn. Some speaker tactics. I don't know how it is in Dubai, but in Sweden now, there's a lot of hybrid meetings. And on Wednesday, I did a short for a networking group, like a speaking gig. And half of the people were in the room and half of the people are online on Zoom. Any advice to a tactic to like do a good speaking gig when half of the people are in the room and half are online?
Yes, I would say that when you speak at an event like that, depends whether you're hosting it or you're speaking or you're being interviewed at it. They're all different sets of mindsets that you need. But consider that you're talking to about 6 or 7 audiences every time that you speak. So the first one you've got is in your own head. The audience of you speaking to you, am I doing it right? Have I got the content good? Is my voice at the right level? So on. So that's the first one. The next audience is the audience in front of you, sitting there watching you. The next audience after that is the audience listening to them and watching them, because an audience at home watching on TV is going to feel the same emotions and want to clap and cheer and boo on whatever they're feeling from the audience in front of you. Then you've got to also consider the show caller or the manager of the event, because you've got to keep them sweet. They've got a time, they've got a schedule, and if you overrun or you go too early or you do the wrong thing according to what you'd agreed, then they won't invite you back again. Then you've got your sponsors of the event. We're wondering, what do I get from all this money that I put into the event? Are all these speakers up to scratch? And if so, would I like to work with any of them again after that? And then on top of it, you've got your own brand. So you've grown the brand. You should be videoing what it is that you're doing. And as you're videoing it, as you're presenting and talking, you should be thinking, am I recording this properly? Am I relying on the guys that are recording it to be able to give me proper footage? Or am I going to wait for 3 weeks and then we say, oh, we just made a promo and you're on it for 3 seconds? I always bring my own camera, so I record it anyway. And I get access to the footage of what's being streamed on YouTube, because then I can edit into snippets and use that for future stuff as well. So my advice is, look at it as a big picture, because if you can work it as a big picture, and most can't, and 99% of people plus didn't even think of what I just said about the different audiences there, that's a little bit that if you think about, if you can work all these guys at the same time effortlessly and still talk and present and host an interview, then you become a very valid person to have on events. Because the formula for being paid is 2 things. It's not what people believe, oh yeah, I'm really good. It's not that. It's the effect of a job that you do and how cheaply you can be replaced by somebody else. If you're really good at speaking, and there's loads of people that are great at speaking, but you can do all this different stuff at the same time and you never drop a ball and it's always a great event, then you are the one that will pay the big bucks for. Mm. And so that's been my business model. I recently hosted the T20 World Cup cricket. I know nothing about cricket. I don't even particularly like cricket. But what I do know is how to work live audiences, having done the rugby sevens for 20 years. And I do know that with a little bit of coaching, I'll work out how to do the cricket, what to say here, all the rest of it. So I hosted about 7 or 8 games, international, the TV, and a live audience. And by the end of it, I was very, very good at it. When I first started, I sucked. But I had a team who were telling me rather loudly in my ear, do it this way, Dave, do it that way. And as long as your ego says, I want to learn and I'm keen to find out, so I'm not going to take it personally, then you can be in a position afterwards where now I can be hired for any cricket game and I can knock it out of the park and score a six every time because I know what it is I'm doing.
Was it out at the cricket stadium in Dubai or?
Yeah, the event was in the UAE, so I was in Abu Dhabi, Dubai, and Sharjah. Oh, it was T20 won by Australia, but just about every cricket nation was involved. It was a huge event.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, cricket is something in Sweden, but I went to the cricket game there, actually. I saw Pakistan-Australia at the stadium in Dubai, 20,000 people, and I think it was 19,500 Pakistanis and maybe 500 Australians, and all the Pakistanis, they thought I was Australian, so they were like screaming at me. It was really interesting experience.
It is, and it's very different with the different audiences, because when you're working with Pakistanis or Sri Lankans or Bangladeshis or Indians, they really want to be spoon-fed what they can do to interact and have fun and shout and cheer and all the rest of it. When you're working with Westerners who tend to be British or Australian or New Zealanders, they tend to want you to shut up and watch the cricket. They'll cheer when somebody's done something good, but the rest of the time, we don't want to clap. We don't want to sing a song. We want to watch this. And that's a cultural thing. So it's fascinating to see when you've got England against India, say, and you're trying to get the audience worked up. Do you push it so everyone has to join in, or do you just work the Indians, in which case the Brits will feel that they have to participate? So when it comes back to their choice, they'll feel that there's a to and fro going on. So there's a lot of dynamics that go in with something like that. Plus also you've got the TV watching and they just want to see if there's an atmosphere.
Interesting. Yeah, so you need to adjust to the audience watching. Yeah. I've seen you speak a couple of times, and I think you're very good at inspiring, educating, and entertaining, you know, all those three aspects that I think a good talk should be of. Does this come natural to you, or like how much is trained and how much is like, this is Dave Crane's personality?
Well, it is natural to me. Remember, I'm a black kid that grew up in white areas in the UK. And so you learn to be very good at fighting. You learn to be very funny, or that's it, or good at sport or whatever it is. And I found that what I am brilliant at, my superpower is working out the Wi-Fi code of the people in front of me. So with a live audience, that's, you know, 100,000 people in an audience, I'll work out the Wi-Fi code of how to talk to them, what their interests are, and how to get a response very quickly, the same as I do in a one-to-one. And so that put me in a position where we've known each other for a long time. Neither of us has a very big ego, but we're very professional at what we do. And on stage, we're in charge because that's our job. But when we're not doing it, we're humble, good guys. And so I found that because speaking is my craft, when I stopped being a DJ and started becoming a speaker, I was always, even now, perfecting how to get better and better and better. So, for instance, with my Dave Crane Daily Show that I was doing on LinkedIn, which I'll be starting up again, and this is one of the sets that I'll be using, the idea is to take that as a keynote that you can bring on the road. And so people will say, we want to hire you to do a keynote. And in fact, my new one is How to Be Unstoppable as a keynote and as a book and as a TV show, as a podcast. And all those things will all come together because it's going to have a single brand. Now, when we talked about Joe Rogan is a brilliant comedian and TV personality, as well as the world's biggest podcaster. And he's also one of the most prolific comedians going on the road. And he talks about how he will start at the beginning of a tour, not really having any material, but really writing his material hard as he goes along until by the end of the season or the run, he's got a brand new routine that's fantastic. Every joke works and people love it. Then he does a Netflix special, burns his material because everyone's seen it, then starts again from scratch for next year. So he creates a new set of shows every single year. And I think as a speaker, you should be considering that kind of business model. But saying that, for the likes of Tony Robbins and Jack Canfield and many other big stars that we have now, Brian Tracy, they've dined off the same books forever. But I think that doesn't necessarily tap into the new world we're in. Tony Robbins got it straight away. He created these huge banks of screens. So rather than having people go along to his concerts, they can be on this tennis court-sized stadium, and he's probably physically bigger than that anyway, of all these banks of Zoom people. So he can talk to them, move around, do all this kind of stuff. That's the future. You've got to consider where your audience is, what they want, and how to get the Wi-Fi code right so you engage them and ultimately give them what they're willing to pay for.
Yeah. No, and that's also a quite nice story about reinventing oneself. We talked about reinventing ourselves in the beginning, you know, when we had tough times, you know, what to do. And I think Tony Robbins did it in a nice way. You know, he said that I never canceled a show ever in my life. And suddenly I couldn't. I mean, there was against the law to do a show, so I had to cancel. And then he set up that studio that is just amazing. And if you're listening and you haven't seen that studio, just maybe Google Tony Robbins, like a Zoom studio or something. It's amazing how he did it.
But you have to remember, Tony Robbins has got $4 billion in the bank. Yeah, so yeah. When it comes to set up a studio, it doesn't happen by accident. And this is one of the things that I found fascinating, because I spent a lot of time studying success and what makes people, you know, at the top of their game. When you talk about Elon Musk or Mark Zuckerberg or Bill Gates or many of those huge stars that we all revere and say, they're the best businessmen in the world. They also were some of the richest people going into their business before they made a run success. So I'm not saying they weren't capable of doing all this stuff. But like, for instance, I can't remember if it's Bill Gates. It might have been Bill Gates or Steve Jobs. His mum was the lawyer for IBM. Bill Gates. So Bill Gates drops out of high school. He's a little geeky, nerdy guy who programs this idea of a future computer. But he's talking to the head of IBM because his mum works for him. You think he's going to get an audience? Of course he is. This is my son. What do you think? Well, let's give it a go. So therefore, he went from a position of strength to being working with the world's biggest computer company. Now, I'm not saying he wasn't a genius. Clearly, he's a genius and a really good guy. But you should only look at your own journey and say, where did I go from A to B or from A to Z? What's my trajectory? Don't compare yourself to anybody else and feel I'm not good enough, because they don't start where you are.
Yeah, I think Keith Cunningham said this, even Tony Robbins had to start at the end of the line and then build it out slowly.
But if you're Tony Robbins, you're also 7 foot. So you can see the front of the line from where you're standing.
Move. I want to get ahead. Yeah. How old is your daughter now?
She's 11 years old now.
11 years old.
Maya's so fantastic. She's got a YouTube channel with 5,000 subscribers. So she can monetize it if she wants to. Oh. And her videos get on average about 100,000 views.
Oh, excellent. On TikTok as well, or just YouTube?
No, she just does YouTube. Okay. So she's much more popular and successful than I am, and she's 11. So as a dad, what I want to do, because I'm not a big lover of universities at all. I think that the education world is out of date. And as a business model, it's holding on by its fingernails. Even with the pandemic, it's difficult to justify, you know, sending kids to school, learning the subjects that might not guarantee them for a job that doesn't exist yet. So for me, I want my daughter, she works with myself and my wife, Aziza. And she's doing tasks, little bits of tasks about this and that. But I see her being able to start her own business by the time she's about 14, 15. So she'll be able to start earning her own money. So when it comes to university, she can choose when she wants to go. She might choose not to. But the thing is, and you know this, Oscar, yourself, because a lot of the world we've been through in the last 2 years has been a reaction to not doing what you want, but doing what you have to pay bills. If you know how to make money, and you know that it's effortless because you've got all these skills, and she'll be like a mini-me agency. She'll know how to create stuff for anybody, content and videos and all sorts. Then you are able to dictate what happens to yourself for the rest of your life. You're not reacting to circumstances. You're not reacting to governments and all the rest of it. You are financially independent, whether it's huge money or small money. So I want my daughter to think like that all the time. And at the age of 11, it's working.
That's great. No, because I wanted to ask, because I know you also talk a little bit about trends and future and stuff. So I wanted to ask, when she's, you know, 20, maybe 25, 10, 15 years from now, what are some things?
Will I be dead?
How does the world look like? Or what are some trends that you see?
I'm a real believer that the world that my daughter is going to create is going to be a lot better than the world that we will leave to them. Our generation are a bunch of dicks, to be honest with you. Mine especially, you're a little bit younger than me. But selfish, egotistic, thinking about the only thing that matters is making money. Forget the climate, forget looking after people who don't have so much. Forget the fact that you've got an international world that's connected online, but let's pretend that we've got borders we won't let people connect to. That's my generation, and I hate it, and I find it repulsive. And I hate the way that right now politics is moving into a really selfish, authoritarian way. My daughter, when she goes on to play Minecraft or About Me or whatever the game is that she's playing, About Us, I think it is, where you're on a spacecraft. They've got all these different games, robots, whatever. They're connected to kids all around the world who don't care who you are, where you are, as long as you play together. Sometimes they talk, sometimes they don't, sometimes they collaborate and join each other, sometimes they disappear. My daughter does collabs with people all around the world on YouTube. They'll make a video, she'll make a video, she'll contribute to it, they'll contribute to hers, they'll never meet, but they talk. So that starts off planting in her head, it doesn't matter where you're from, I like you potentially because you could be a good person. We didn't get that. You and I learned this because we went to Dubai and we realized that the world is full of really good people, not just our lot. And we realized that we might think, I'm from Great Britain. We're not Great Britain. We're really crap Britain at the moment. And we got no friends because we left Brexit. So it was only when I left the UK to go to Dubai and I watched us play football as England, I realized that the rest of the world's going, oh, bless. This guy thinks he's really good at it. And we keep getting beaten, but we don't want to, don't tell him, just give him a beer to cry into. And now we've got a great England team, so I'm not going to complain about it too much. But I think that the world that my daughter will inherit hopefully will turn around and say, all this stuff is crap. Let's make a world that's connected, and let's make a world where we're not looking at each other, we're looking at the world outside. So like, for instance, when you get married, you go from being in a relationship where you're eyeballing each other to both looking ahead at where you're going. I'd like to see a world that does the same thing. So the countries aren't fighting over Ukraine, Russia, and oil and the and pipelines and crap like that. They're saying, right, you've got your country, I've got our country, we've got international business. How can we get out there and do some more stuff up there? How can we put stuff into the atmosphere that's going to make the world better? How can we use wind power and solar power and stop digging up the world? Like, for instance, I've got clients who work in sustainable energy. They used to work in oil and gas. They still do partly, but what we've done is set up wind fields, and they manage these wind fields for countries. So they're creating the same amount of power. Got one client, for instance, went from $300 million a year to $1 billion a year by embracing green, changing their business model, and finding a ton more clients and a ton more staff. Because people are saying, we want some of that. We want to get rid of fossil fuels. So I do believe that that is a direction that everybody should consider, whatever their business, and have faith in the young people because they're smarter than we are. They're born to Google. They had a phone or an iPad in their hands when they were born, and they're not going to have the same hang-ups as we do because they'll just go, no, I don't care where that person's from. They're my friend, and you can shut up.
Yeah, no, I have this theory that or this thing that I'm working on, strategic tech coaching, is that technology can be used for bad and it can be used for good. And these are beautiful examples on how you can use technology for good, you know, connect your people from all over the world. Doesn't matter what race or color you're from, you know, just if you do good, you're, you know, contribute.
Sorry to interrupt you, Oscar.
No.
Yeah. I was going to say, before we change the thread, now I host a lot of big events, global events. So recently I was hosting the Global CIO Forum. So you got 250 CIOs, Chief Information Officers, from all around the world, big companies, Microsoft, whoever it is. And they are typically Mr. Spock. When there's a break, they don't talk to each other. They go on their phones and they huddle like that because they're very shy, because they're used to typing and using systems rather than talking to each other. And so I was hosting this. I had a panel, and the panel are talking about the future. I said, guys, can I just ask you a question? Where are all the women? Where's all the women in the industry? And they all start looking at their feet sheepishly and sort of like half guilty. Oh, yes, we need to get more women. I said, okay. How are you going to do it? What do you mean? Well, we agree we need to get. So how are you going to get them? And they couldn't come up with an answer. It was about five women in the room of about 250 men. And that's what the problem is, because when we're talking about future, and this is what inspired me to talk about this, when you're talking about tech and where we're going, right now it's a battle to see who's going to do the most dangerous bot with a gun on it, or those horrible dogs that look like coffee tables that if you put a gun on, it will kill you. There's a TV show what's called War of the Worlds where these things have guns on them, and they're just going up and down the street and shooting everybody, because how are you going to stop a coffee table made of metal? That's not how women think. Women will think about nurturing, about relationships, about helping people. And we saw that in the pandemic. If you look at the female leaders, Jacinta Ardern in New Zealand, Britain lost 169,000 people. New Zealand lost 53. Now, you can talk about the difference in the size of a country, but that's not the thing. The fact is, she said, we're in this together. I'll keep you safe. Who's in? And they said, we are. And they followed her lead. And they did lockdown, unlike Sweden. They did lockdown, but then they opened it up and then they locked it down. And then she accepted, look, we're not going to be able to lock it down and keep it out, but let's just be careful what we do. And so the best results came from females around the world. There's no look at me. I'm hunky and I'll never catch anything. And so the more women we put into tech and the more the next generation embraces it, and the more we should force women into tech, get them in there, give them great jobs, support them, help them nurture, bring all the geeks together so they don't sit on their own playing games, and they connect and create apps that make the world better. That's what we need.
Yeah, yeah. No, I normally take this example. You can use drones to drop bombs, and then you have these drones that drop blood to the rural Rwanda, I think. So same technology, just different usage, you know, drop bombs. Absolutely. Or kill people or save lives. Same technology, different uses. You know?
Well, look at the idea of family. Right now, Meta is working on this idea of turning the whole world into the Matrix. Now, from what Cambridge Analytica has done and the stuff that's happened with Brexit and so on around the world, for many people, for me, not for everybody, I worry about where this is going because it's not accountable. At no point are we able to dictate where it's going. And on many occasions, the social media platforms have admitted the reason that they're so successful is because all they do is treat us as the product. It's about making it sticky so we can't leave. So if you make any option, then you get an advert related to that option that will take you down a rabbit hole. So you get that all the time. I don't believe that's what's done by women. I think that they want to make it better for everybody so we grow. Not just about the money, about other things and other values. So that's one of the reasons I want to see more women in tech, because I don't think the direction that we're going in metaverse would be that where they would send us. And just for the record, and I don't want to spend this time bashing Mark Zuckerberg because he doesn't care. But if you think about it, about the idea of revealing a metaverse, who's in, it's almost like saying 2.8 billion gamers during the last 2 years who didn't even notice a pandemic because they only ever got pizza shoved under the door from their mom when they're going and playing blooming Fortnite. They've been in a metaverse forever with their own avatars. And then this is not news at all. So get over it and just see what we can do to make the world a better place instead of one that's shaped in your own image.
Yeah. Yeah. 2022, Dave Crane, what is your focus for the coming months?
Well, one of the great things that happened during the pandemic is it brought me and my wife closer together. I was a speaker, training speakers. She was an award-winning wedding photographer. And we had no employment, nothing. So we had to find a way to make it all work. And today I was filming a video for a big event I'm doing. And the gentleman who's doing a video videography told me that him and his wife had split. She's gone back to her home country with the kids, left him there because she didn't believe that things were going to get better. He said, stick around, they will do. And she just lost her philosophy and went. My wife and I dug in deep and we said, how are we going to fix this? And we worked 24/7 on our business together, making sure my daughter and my dogs and my livelihood is looked after, that we're growing a sustainable business that will allow us to be able to travel to any country and move along with that. And so my year ahead will be a combination of doing live gigs, also setting up the Industry Icon program to be able to work with people at the top of their game and elevate them. So, I mean, for instance, one of the gentlemen who's working with me is a construction director who's worked on some big construction projects like Atlantis 2 and Burj Khalifa. And he's helped to put, I mean, these are big names of construction. And he said to me, I want to start doing my own business. Well, not necessarily my own business. I want to take a step back from working with people and grow my own brand. So we've been working on his brand, his Industry Icon program. He sent me a message the other day saying that I've had three job offers this month, including one where they said, we want to jump on a Zoom call with you. I went on a Zoom call, said, I'm not interested in working with you. I'm plenty busy. They said, look, take our details. We'll work with you at any time of day. We're desperate to have you. And he said, it's not because of my CV. And it's not because of the companies I've worked for or the projects I've done. It's because my brand is out there now and people see that and they say, that's the guy that I want. And he said, that wouldn't have happened unless I was working with you. So it's taken a little bit of time to get those kind of bits of feedback from people who understand that the growth and the certainty you send to a market has a knock-on effect on how much people want to work with celebrities. And it's not being a celebrity, it's that being an industry icon, it's being an influencer in your own niche, just saying, I'm good at this and therefore you should work with me.
Excellent. So yeah, we'll put a link to more information about your industry icon program. But I think the lesson of today is to take responsibility and build that personal brand, and like your daughter is doing as well. So that's.
But it sounds like I'm some kind of like Fagin from Oliver Twist and forcing my daughter to go to. She doesn't do anything she doesn't want to do. She's a product of me and her mom. And the mum won't do anything she doesn't want to do. And the daughter's the same. So she does what she loves. And we're steering it as parents, but very much a case of she's creating her own way forward.
Okay.
And
okay.
I think that's really important because I would hate to be one of these crushing parents where the kid has to escape from your clutches to find out who they are. My daughter can be anybody she wants. I just want her to be happy. And I'd love her to find her own way of earning so she can send herself to university.
Yeah, in Sweden we hold this. We have the ice hockey dads, you know, that drives the kids to the ice hockey and forces them to play ice hockey, but they don't want to play. Just, you know,
I would never do that. My daughter's doing kickboxing. In fact, today she's meant to be doing kickboxing, and she wasn't very well last night, so she came back from school feeling a little bit sick. I don't know whether that's her way of getting out of kickboxing. Because we just said to her, you'll get this from Dubai, we want you to do kickboxing, we want you to get slapped about a little bit, because the rest of the world is not like Dubai, where you can't, in any other part of the world, people steal your phone if you go to the bathroom and leave your phone on the table. Yeah. If you're on your computer in the lobby of a hotel and you go up to the bathroom and come back again, your computer's gone with all your bags.
Yeah.
I want my daughter to be able to understand that if we do go somewhere else, not everybody's going to ignore you or give you a hug. There's a real world out there. So today we're going to let her off going to kickboxing if she feels sick, but then I'll give her a home lesson, which doesn't mean I'm going to slap my daughter about. We've got punch bags and stuff. I'll hold it while she kicks it.
Yeah, and I remember one summer I was coming back to Sweden, and I worked a lot from coffee shops, especially when I was in Sweden over the summer. And I went to this coffee shop, and I left the laptop, and I went to the toilet to go to the toilet. And then I came back, and I'm like, I cannot do this. I'm at the central station in Stockholm. In Dubai, it's fine, but here, no way. But luckily, it wasn't stolen. But yeah, it's a little bit protected world down there.
So. It is. And also, you've got to remember that being spoiled in Dubai. Dubai is, because of the nature of the visas, if you haven't got a visa, it becomes very expensive, and at some point, you have to leave. It's like all the kids who used to hand in their homework from school. So you've got a better quality of person who really wants to be there and go to work and protect their livelihood. You haven't got a number of people being unemployed or in the drug world or criminals or whatever. I don't mean this with disrespect to anybody who's finding their feet, who's been through these challenges. But everybody knows that if you commit a crime in Dubai, you're probably going to find your way to prison or you probably find your way to the airport. So very few people do it because Dubai's got a very simple policy. If you're in a fight with somebody and they punch you in the face, both of you are going to a police station. Why? Because it takes one person to throw a punch, it takes another person to get punched in the face. You're both guilty. And so nobody fights, or very few people fight because they understand that.
Yeah. So my last question to you, Davey, if you had a magic wand and you could teach something to everyone in the world, what would you teach them?
I would teach people the nature of happiness and teach them how to be able to learn to create happiness in themselves so they didn't have to be crappy to other people while they're doing it. So be motivated, get into the zone, do what you do every single day that makes you happy, dump all the stuff that doesn't make you happy. Because here's the thing, and I think it's changed in the last 2 years. You and I were born into a world that was so driven by how much money can you make. If you make loads of money and become really famous, you are clearly the best person on the planet. And if you've not made enough money and you haven't, and you've struggled and you're not happy, then therefore you're the crappiest person in the world and you deserve to die unhappy. That's basically the view that's driven by capitalism and so on. But the pandemic showed you that maybe you're not making a ton of money, but you managed to pay your bills and you watch TV and you sat back with a glass of wine or a cup of tea and some biscuits and you went, oh, this is so good to be alive. That happiness there is what most people don't seem to get. I think we're starting to get it now, but we're really confused as to what how we get it, and it seems by accident. If you start off with the ability to know what makes you happy, and it might involve work, and it might involve relationships, and it might involve self-care, and it might involve doing what you love as opposed to doing what you've always had to do, then that means that your ambitions change. Your ambitions are more benevolent. Your ambitions about helping other people to find where they are, because you've got plenty surplus and you can help others. And that's the one thing I would like to teach the world, how to be happy. And also with that, how to earn your own money and how to look after finances. Even though I'm not an expert on that bit, I've had to learn it the hard way. And that's what doesn't get taught at school. You're taught how to do the school system. And if you rebel against it, say you get 3 out of 10 for your maths. Well, here's the thing. In the classroom, you're a bit of a dunce, sit at the back. But it so happens you might be a genius artist. Why does it matter if you don't learn maths? Just get somebody else in to do it, or use a calculator, or ask Siri. I'm just waiting for my phone to probably turn on now. How to do it. You should work on your own skills and learn what makes you happy. And if everybody did that, they wouldn't be so crappy to each other. They'd go, I'm glad you're happy. You've got these skills. I've got my skills. How can we put them together and make the whole world happier as well?
Perfect. Thank you. Let's end it at that. Any final words for the listeners?
Yeah, Oscar, I love you, and it's great to see you. And anybody who's listening to this show, Oscar is one of the nicest guys I've ever met in my entire life. Super talented, brilliant coach, amazing speaker. You should subscribe to his podcasts and his social media and make sure you connect with him personally. Get him to coach you if you can, because you won't regret it. He's an amazing guy. And Oscar, it's a pleasure to connect with you again after so long. And I can't wait to do it again.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Dave. It was really fun talking to you.
You too.
Wow, that was really cool. It was super fun to speak to Dave Crane again. And there was some really cool, valuable tips that he shared. So yeah, I really recommend you to follow Dave Crane on LinkedIn. And I'll put the link to his LinkedIn on the show notes to this episode, and also some other links to some of the programs that he offers. So learn more about Dave Crane by clicking on those links. He's a great guy, and really, I mean, he's done this for such a long time. So yeah, you should really learn from him. And also thank you so much for listening to the Strategic Tech Coaching podcast. And yeah, you can follow us on Instagram, Strategic Tech Coaching, or on YouTube. There's more videos. So just search on Strategic Tech Coaching on YouTube. And yeah, I hope to see you somewhere around the world. Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you for listening to the Strategic Tech Coaching podcast with your host, Oscar Ndermo. We'll catch you next time.